afternoon. May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Ramazan Shaheen. Mr. Shaheen's rights to counsel and a fair trial were violated when his attorney told the fact finder his own opinion that his client was untruthful and his own lack of confidence in his client's case. By discrediting Mr. Shaheen and crediting the state's case, counsel deprived Mr. Shaheen of a trial that can be relied upon as having produced a just result.
This is reminding me of another case where a lawyer approached a trial judge and said, my client is about to commit perjury.
Yes.
And this is the Shockley case. And that was addressed under Rule 61, and a Strickland analysis was applied by this court in addressing the duties that the lawyer has to the client and the duty of candor that the lawyer has to the court.
Yes.
Now, Strickland analysis, by definition, precludes a chronic analysis. So why isn't your claim premature?
Because chronic does apply in this case, and it is like, as this court is well aware, of Cook versus State, where the entirety of the proceedings were infected through the conduct of the attorney in this case. It wasn't a matter of specific areas that he failed in, such as he didn't investigate this or he didn't present that argument. Before trial, during trial, and at the close of trial, the attorney's conduct in front of a fact finder it deprived Mr. Shaheen of a trial that can be seen as reliable.
Your brief suggests that the fact it was a bench trial makes it even more egregious.
Yes, that is correct. Because what happened here is he's talking to the fact finder. So before trial, he tells the fact finder, I told my client he should plea because it would be in his best interest based on the evidence the state has. And other jurisdictions have said, such as a Butler versus United States, I believe, in the District of Columbia Circuit, that once an attorney tells the fact finder that, it's impossible for that judge to be able to fairly judge the case and decide the facts of the case. Similarly, he also told the judge several times as a fact finder that he disagreed with his client that he needed an interpreter and essentially communicated that he was lying.
Ms. Walker, I believe that in your reply brief, you made a statement along the lines of, if this trial attorney had problems that he needed to air with the court, he should have aired it before a judge other than the one that was going to be the fact finder.
That's correct.
Is there a procedure, some sort of recognized procedure, whereby a lawyer situated, where this lawyer was, could do that?
I don't believe there's a formal procedure. I do know that it happens where at any time the attorney could request to go before another judge. But in this case, he shouldn't even get there. The state contends that he was trying to protect himself in the situation. There was absolutely no claim by the client of ineffective assistance of counsel. Therefore, he had no obligation to respond to that on the record, that potentially someday there may be an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, as I understood your brief, consistent with that, if we wanted to distinguish Shockley, is a case where you have an affirmative duty as a defense attorney and not to compromise the administration of justice by presenting perjured testimony.
That's correct.
So the defense attorney is confronted with a dilemma that he needs to address.
That's correct.
As I understand your brief, there was no need for the lawyer to say, by the way, judge, the state had a strong case. He made a mistake not taking the plea.
That's correct.
There was no need for the attorney to say, by the way, judge, my client doesn't need an interpreter. I had no problem getting along with him, and he wants an interpreter so he can play possum.
Correct.
All of which seems to compromise the attorney-client privilege.
That's correct.
So what you're distinguishing this from other cases by saying the defense attorney volunteered prejudicial information to the trier of fact in a bench trial that was completely unnecessary.
That's correct. And in fact, other jurisdictions that have addressed this, such as Lowry versus Caldwell, which actually did deal with a potentially perjurious situation, the court there said that even the action by the defense attorney during questioning of his client, stopping questioning, moving to withdraw without stating why, and then not questioning any further, was sufficient to communicate to the fact finder he thought his client was lying and it was an unfair trial. Here, as Your Honor points out, we are nowhere near that landscape. We're in a case here where the judge did not even ask him, did not even ask defense counsel for his opinion. He presented it about about 10 times.
Well, just to follow up on, I guess, my question and Justice Holland's, we now have the trial judge who didn't ask for this information, and let us assume there was no need for that information to be imparted to the trial judge, but there it is.
Yes. What
should the trial judge have done?
At that particular point, I would state that she should have recused herself. However, this isn't in her court. The ball wasn't in her court. It was in defense counsel's court. So obviously, because defense counsel was being ineffective, he didn't ask for the court to be recused because he didn't know that what he didn't believe what he was doing was incorrect. And this court in Watson versus State addressed a similar situation where the family court judge had two trials back to back with one defendant, and they were obviously bench trials there. And the court noted that she had made an assessment in the first trial that the defendant was lying as he had taken the stand, and she found him guilty, or discredited him, I should say.
So basically, for us to rule, for us to accept your argument, we in effect would have to say that the trial judge erred by not recusing herself and having the case heard by another judge.
I guess that would be the end result, but the challenge is to to the defense attorney's actual conduct here and in providing that information to her.
Let's say for a moment that everything transpired the way it did, except for the fact that after the defense counsel told the judge, you know, I don't think my client is telling the truth here, or whatever the words were, the judge responded on the record and said, well, I'm the fact finder here. I'm going to judge the credibility of all the witnesses when the trial is presented, and I'm not going to give any consideration to your gratuitous comment, Mr. Defense Counsel. Mm-hmm. Would that be enough to take care of the problem here?
No, Your Honor. I would suggest that it would not because, again, that was sort of a situation in Watson versus State. The judge did say, I can be fair. That's my job. And the court said, well, look, it does not present an image of impartiality here, and that's the problem we have here.
Well, wasn't that a significantly more troublesome set of circumstances where you know the same defendant had been found guilty by the judge, and now was going to be trying the same defendant a second time? This is nowhere near that serious, is it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, respectfully. I believe it is because the judge did state on the record, one, from what I've seen in the courtroom, I don't believe he needs an interpreter. And she also stated to the defendant, that is my understanding that your attorney has not taken an interpreter to the prison to visit you and that you've been able to communicate with him. And in looking in the context of the entirety of the trial, she asked for an interpreter to protect the record, not because she believed him.
I suppose a third alternative, I mean, I posed one, Justice Berger posed a second. A third might be for the trial judge to react to counsel's comments by saying, counsel, I'm concerned that you have, bordered on, if not actually breached the attorney-client privilege. And I'm concerned about your ability to represent this client competently. I'm going to postpone the trial and appoint somebody else. Could she have done that?
I suppose that would be a way that it could be resolved, certainly. However, at this point, this client's case had gone on for several years, and a lot of that had to do with at his request because he had changed counsel. So whether or not that would have been I mean, it would have been a practical solution. I don't know whether legally it would have been the best interest of the client at that time.
Hypothetically, if a case had been going on for several years and a bilingual defendant says, uh-oh, this time, to his lawyer, all the state's witnesses are here. I didn't think that was going to happen. I think I'll ask for an interpreter because I need somebody who can speak Turkish, and they're not easily found, and I'll get a continuance. Maybe next time they won't show up. And then he tells the lawyer that, goes in front of the judge, and asks for an interpreter. The lawyer's to stand silent?
Yes, Your Honor. He does not have an obligation to counter his client. His job is to say, my client has requested an interpreter. To the extent the court feels that it's necessary to get to the bottom of it in a situation like that, another judge could have done it, and arguably that would violate his the attorney-client privilege, because he's not stating that he is in fact going to lie. And in fact, that's undercut in this case, quite frankly, because...
Well, where's the candor to the court if the client speaks English fluently and asks for an interpreter without justification, and the lawyer knows that?
With all due respect, the attorney's opinion is not relevant. The attorney does not know the extent to which his client can and cannot understand English. It may seem to him he can understand English very well. In this case, if the court had looked to the docket, an interpreter was used at a hearing back about 5 months prior. And 5 days before trial, there was a teleconference where on the docket, the clerk noted, an interpreter may no longer be needed. So there had been discussion. This wasn't a day of trial thing where the client is saying, I want an interpreter because I don't want these people to show up. This had been an issue before, and the judge said, this is the first time I've heard of a request. And quite frankly, for whatever reason, that there had been an issue before, and counsel did not correct her with respect to that. So this isn't that situation. So this is a situation where it's his opinion. There had been a need for an interpreter before. The judge had the opportunity to look at the video and decide whether he understood English 100% or not, and it is his right to a fair trial. And if he wants an interpreter there, and unless the client says to him, I understand 100% clearly, but I want an interpreter anyways, if that were the case and there needed to be some candor in that respect, we go to another judge, the fact finder.
Your point is, if someone requests an interpreter, and there has to be a judicial determination that you need an interpreter, it doesn't really matter what the lawyer says one way or the other. The judge either says, yes, we need an interpreter, or no, we don't.
That's correct.
And in this case, to the extent that there was a suggestion by the attorney without ever being asked, there wasn't a need for an interpreter, it violated the attorney-client privilege.
That's correct. Yes, see, he was not even asked for his opinion, and he gave it. And it would be similar to a situation, even if he had been asked, where a defense attorney gets two different stories from his client. It's not for the defense attorney to decide which one's true and which one's not, to decide whether he needs to tell the court, he told me two different stories, so I think one of these is a lie.
But well, is it fair to say that this attorney believed, as a matter of fact, that the client was fluent in English?
Yes. I believe that he did. And it's clear that he had problems with his own client's honesty, because he also put on the record about a discussion that they had as to what judge was going to preside that day. And without the defendant present, and by the way, most of these comments were made without the client's presence, he said to the court, to the judge, my client denies that we had a discussion regarding who the judge was going to be. And he says, we did have that discussion. He's basically said he's wrong. So he's indicating more content to show that he is putting out there that his client is not telling the truth. He's also stated on the record that his client did not want his story tested when he takes the stand. He said to the judge,
"Your Honor, if the attorney believes that in good faith, beyond a reasonable doubt, doesn't the attorney have a duty of candor with the court? Or must the attorney have allowed the fraud upon the court to be committed?
If the attorney's own opinion, the client has not told him, If it's his opinion, no, he does not disclose that to the court.
Well, how's that any different when a lawyer determines beyond a reasonable doubt in his own mind that the client is going to commit perjury?
In that situation is one where he has found out, either by the client has told him directly. Okay, attorneys make opinions all the time as which one of the stories your client's telling you is the truth. And as long as I don't, as a defense attorney, go in and say and affirmatively sponsor that testimony, perjured testimony, then the client still gets the opportunity to put that before the court. And in fact, when there is potentially perjured testimony, the attorney does not have to say that. He says, my client's going to testify in the narrative. Again, when you're dealing with a fact finder, we can always go to a different judge to discuss these things. This is a complete subset of most trials. This isn't every time we have a trial and this situation arises that this would be a problem. This arises when the judge is the fact finder.
Well, I think you're focusing maybe overly on one side of the equation. It's an unfortunate, perhaps inconvenient fact that even if the attorney did do something that impaired the fairness of the trial or the attorney-client privilege, this court cannot, as an institution, cannot reverse unless there was error committed by the trial judge. And that is at least where I personally am having a problem here. That is, I think it's incumbent upon the appellant to identify, to articulate the nature of the error that was made, not simply that the attorney may have gone off and on a tangent and impaired a right of the client.
Yes, but Cronick and Cook state that when there is a lack of any meaningful adversarial testing, prejudice is presumed. And that's what happened here. For the attorney to go in and say...
So the court should have sua sponte done something. I mean, we're focusing here on what the court did or didn't or should have done. And that's where I need some guidance.
Yes, the court should have done something, quite frankly.
What?
Should have recused herself and could have had a trial with a different judge. Or... had him take these issues to a different judge and she could have handled the trial, depending on how much had been disclosed to her at that point.
Well, but how was she to know that he was going to be divulging this type of
right.
information? How could she have stopped
it? Right. She would not have. So if she saw him starting to go down that route, she probably could have stopped it. But he did volunteer this several times. And we're not just talking about the interpreter situation. As I mentioned, he communicated to her that he wanted to testify in a narrative and not be questioned on cross-examination, indicating his client does not want to have his story tested. And that wasn't necessary either, because he did eventually testify subject to cross-examination. Again, if he needed help explaining this to his client, another judge could have assisted in that case.
So your point is that the first time he started talking about things that were negative about his client or conversations he'd had that would be privileged, and the judge should have said, I had to remind you, this is a bench trial,
yes.
And you shouldn't be telling me any adverse things about your client.
That's correct. That's exactly what should have happened, and that did not happen in this case. And I did also want to mention that he also made disparaging remarks about his client by stating that the only problem we had in communicating was his attitude and the fact that he didn't want to answer my questions when we were preparing for trial. And also in his closing, he starts out his closing argument with mitigation evidence, and the judge says, how is that relevant? And he says, well, it's not. It's not a defense. I'm just trying to explain it. Now, he does go on to try to attack the credibility of the prostitutes, but at that point, the attorney has already put out there, has communicated to the judge. And even if she tried, which I have no doubt that she did, to be impartial, as the other cases, Ferguson and Lowry, point out, she'd have to be more than human to be able to compartmentalize those things. So even though the judge would attempt to be impartial, he was deprived of the right to a fair trial.
And just so that I'm clear on this, does your argument depend significantly on the fact that this was a bench trial? In other words, would you agree that information of this sort, even if it's inappropriate, if it were given to the judge in a jury trial, would not warrant a reversal?
Yeah, assuming there weren't any other circumstances, such as voluntariness rulings that the judge would have to make as a fact finder. That's correct. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. In the first instance, as an initial matter, the state's position is that this issue is not ripe, that this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that would more appropriately be handled in a Rule 61 situation because we don't have all the information. The court doesn't have the information. Superior Court didn't have the information. And to speculate at this point as to motivations and decisions and reasons why defense counsel acted the way he did is inappropriate. And
that's only as to the interpreter, though, isn't it? Because we do have all the information with regard to a client should have taken the plea bargain that was offered.
We do have the information that he was explaining that he had a difficult client and that he wanted to make it clear that he had spent a lot of time with his client and that he didn't believe this was in his client's best interest. That is part of the record. What we don't know is why he felt the need to say that. And we don't know why he went on at great length about the interpreter issue.
Would it matter? That is, the claim here is that this goes beyond incompetence. It is a loyalty issue. And that puts it in a different light constitutionally than
loyalty
incompetent
issue.
Representation.
In Strickland, Strickland discusses the fact that a breach of loyalty can be analyzed under that same analysis. And so it doesn't really take it out of a Strickland analysis.
So if that's the case, then basically what you're saying is that, if I understand it right, and tell me if I don't,
yes.
There's a claim that defense counsel divulged information to the court that he shouldn't have divulged by any standard, that procedurally fits into the box of post-conviction incompetent representation claim. It cannot be raised on direct appeal.
The state's position is it would have to be something would have to be so egregious as to be a chronic claim, as in there was no adversarial testing whatsoever. It was a complete attorney failure that could potentially be handled on the record if there are no disputed facts. And this
well,
is
what
not
would be the situation in a bench trial where before the trial ever starts. This is a hypothetical. The attorney says, Judge, I know we're about to begin this bench trial, and I just want you to know the state's evidence is strong, and my client should have taken the plea, and my client is not a credible person, but I'm going to do my best. Would that be a problem that would be reviewed under Cronic or Strickland?
Strickland. To separate bench trials from jury trials, what the defense is asking is that there be a separate rule and that judges cannot put on wear two different hats. They cannot be a manager and a fact finder.
All right. Well, I understand your answer. So then what you're saying is if in a jury trial the defense attorney said, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to start a trial. We probably shouldn't have had a trial if my client would have taken this plea agreement. But notwithstanding the strength of the state's case, my client's decided he wants to have a trial. And I can tell you my client has real credibility problems because I don't believe my client. But I'm going to do my best. Here we go. And you're saying that that would be analyzed under Strickland and not Cronic?
That would be analyzed under why didn't the prosecutor immediately stand up and object and the court declare a mistrial. That's how that would be analyzed. And that's the problem.
Tell me about the problem after you tell me in my hypothetical. Would that be analyzed under Strickland or Cronic?
His behavior at that point, I believe, would be Cronic. Assuming, of course, that the trial did not go on. If there was somehow a court that thought they could give a curative instruction and move on, at that point, you might want to analyze it under Strickland. But normally, something like that would end, presumably, at that point. One would hope that it would end at that point.
The point of my two hypotheticals is to get you to focus on this difference in whether the trier of fact is the judge or the jury. And because your answers to my two hypotheticals were, if the defense attorney had said the exact same words to a jury, we'd look at it under Cronic. But when the defense attorney says the exact same words to the judge who's the trier of fact, we look at it under Strickland.
I understand your question, and I'm not quite sure how to answer that, other than to say that, one, in this case, I don't think anything to that level was said to the judge.
I know. That's why we call them hypotheticals. I'm just trying to understand, as a general proposition, in my hypotheticals, where the same over-the-top comments are made, as I understand your answer to my hypotheticals,
yes,
one before the jury would be analyzed under Cronic, but saying the exact same verbatim things to a judge who's going to do a bench trial would be analyzed under Strickland.
I do believe that judges we hold to a higher standard and that can hear and regularly do hear things that we don't allow juries to hear. Therefore, the fact that a judge has heard things as a judge, be that as a fact finder or at wearing their other hat as a manager of the court, they can compartmentalize those. And a jury doesn't have two roles to play. A jury has a fact-finding role. They can't compartmentalize unless we tell them to, and this court has consistently said, we can instruct them, you can only use that evidence a certain way, and we believe they can. The same thing with a judge. You can tell a judge things that you wouldn't tell a jury, because a judge should be able to compartmentalize without instructing themselves. I can only consider that in terms of how I'm managing my caseload or however.
The state's lead-in, or at least initial response to the appeal, is the kick the can down the road argument. This is not the time to hear this claim. Let's move beyond that. Let's assume that it is properly raised at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the state's substantive response?
Well, the state's substantive response is that this does not meet the Strickland analysis, and that it should be analyzed under Strickland, and that there is no one, it is unclear that there is there is some deficient performance, but not to the extent that defense counsel is saying, and that prejudice cannot be established in a case with this overwhelming evidence, and and therefore the claim would fail under Strickland.
Can I ask you a kind of a practical question? Based upon your understanding of the way criminal trials tend to proceed nowadays, is it that uncommon for a defense counsel to tell the judge, well, you know, my client got a really good plea offer and, hasn't agreed to accept it, more or less under the theory that the judge in his or her managerial role may take that information as an indication that there ought to be some more time for counsel to consult with his client, or that perhaps the state might want to go back to the table, so to speak, but that saying that in and of itself is A, not that unusual, and B, not as prejudicial as it sounds?
In fact, it happens on a regular basis that their deadlines are set for pleas. Those deadlines are extended when it's represented that, well, my client may or may, I think they may take the plea. I'm not sure. I'm still working on them. That doesn't mean, that's not the same thing as conceding guilt, for example, in Cook. To say that I think that it's in my client's best interest to take a plea or consider a plea in certain cases is not saying my client is guilty. It's saying I've looked at the evidence, I'm looking out for my client, and I think that they may be able to prove certain things, and it's not worth the risk, the potential downside, and the downside in this case was huge.
Based on your experience, what percentage of criminal cases are bench trials?
I do not know, but I do not think it is a huge percentage, but I think it happens on a fairly regular basis. For example, frequently in drug cases where there's a suppression hearing, they will then proceed to not only a bench trial, but sometimes a stipulated.
No, I understand that, but to the extent you're routinely talking to a judge about the fact that your client has turned down a plea offer, generally speaking, you'd be talking to a judge who was going to preside over a jury trial.
Generally, except when those comments are made in the cycle of the criminal proceedings is often before a client has made that decision and well, the state has made that decision. So it could go, at the time those comments are being made, it's up in the air.
Can this type of comment, the client or information, that the client has turned down a benevolent plea offer and wants to go to trial, support an inference, well, he really must be innocent, and that he's going to fight this and because he is not guilty? And are there circumstances where that happens, where people are found not guilty?
That certainly happens. And that's it. That's what I'm saying. It's not a concession of guilt. It's in some ways a neutral statement that, although the inference could go the other way, in this particular case, there was.
Well, it all depends on what the lawyer says. The lawyer who says it's a very benevolent plea offer, and I don't understand why this idiot client doesn't take it. I'm going to have to take him to trial before you, despite my better judgment. That's the inference you draw from this comment. It's a little different than the state's given a plea offer that's so whimsically unacceptable that we've turned it down, we're going to trial because my client thinks he's not guilty or can't be proved guilty anyway of those charges. Everything depends on the context of what the lawyer says and how he says it, right?
And the context that the lawyer's coming from, I agree, will certainly affect it. And in this case, the lawyer had already said that his client was not communicating with him and answering questions.
But now, let's go back to the conversation about the plea. In this case, didn't the lawyer on the record say something to the effect, my client turned down what I think is a good plea because of my assessment of the strength of the state's case?
Yes. Yeah.
Ms. McFarland, just to get back to your Strickland argument, even if the case is analyzed under in Strickland terms, defendant's argument is that that what happened here fails abysmally under either branch of that analysis. The argument, as I understand it, is that counsel's performance fell so below an objective standard that it was akin to falling off a cliff, given the nature of what was told to the trial judge. And prejudice in those circumstances, if not presumed, was certainly established here, because what could be more prejudicial than to divulge this type of information, which is attorney-client protected, to the fact finder?
Well, in this case, the first, the state would contend that the defense counsel's performance, although certainly not stellar, was not as egregious as current counsel would have the court believe. The problem
is... Didn't fall off a cliff, it just jumped down one notch in the stairway?
Yeah, closer to that. In the sense that, one, it's difficult for the state to defend without knowing the facts, that without having the attorney defend himself. I can certainly speculate as to why a defense counsel would talk a lot about, for example, the interpreter issue when he's caught on the day of trial not having procured an interpreter. He realizes now that perhaps his client just tells him that morning, now I want an interpreter. He's stuck. He's going to have to explain to a judge why he didn't do something that he should have done ahead of time. And this particular lawyer is known for his gift of gab, and he went on too long. That's a reasonable interpretation of the record of what he said. Can the state say that that's what happened exactly? No, because we don't have evidence of what the defense counsel was thinking, what happened, or
Remind
anything
me,
else.
Who was the defense attorney in this case?
It was Peter Letang. He was an experienced attorney. He certainly, was not new. However, the state can only speculate, and that's the problem at this point in time. However, assume that that is a reasonable thing, that that is what happened, then that's not so egregious. That's not outside the realm of reasonable behavior. Attorneys often speak to judges about plea issues, other things, and once again, that's not unusual. They even do it during trial, pre-trial, and this judge had also seen or had access to, I believe had seen, the videotaped statement that the defendant had given and was well aware of the level of proof that was out there in this case. So this wasn't news. This wasn't something different. As to prejudice, the prejudice in Strickland is, would need to be so egregious that the prejudice have to be that the outcome of trial would perhaps have been different. In this case, there is no possibility that it would have been different. We have a judge who said, I will look at things fairly. We have counsel who cross-examined witnesses, tried to poke holes in their credibility, and yet there were statements. The client himself who testified was, in fact, did himself no favors by doing so.
But isn't that one of the differences between the Strickland standard and the Chronic standard? If you're successful under a Chronic argument and there's a breakdown in the adversarial system, you don't have to show the result would have been different, do you?
That is correct.
So you only have to show the result would have been different when you're talking about the prejudice prong of Strickland.
That is correct. However, in this case, it was not a complete breakdown of the adversarial system. And the counsel did say those things, but he also said, and I will represent my client to the best of my abilities and defend him, and he did. He cross-examined, he argued, he did what he was supposed to do in the courtroom. And so there is no breakdown of the system in that sense in this case. Certainly not to the level of Chronic. This was not an attorney who did nothing, didn't talk to his client, came in and slept at the table. That is not this case. And that is why prejudice needs to be shown. And there is none in this case. The judge did very clearly say on the record that she was sworn to uphold the law and to be fair and impartial, and that she would listen to all the evidence and be fair. She and this was in front of the defense of the defendant, and in reaction to something his attorney had said, she made it clear. I understand. He's just saying this stuff. I'm here. I'm your judge, and I will be fair. And there is nothing to show anything different. The evidence in this case was so overwhelming that the state rarely has a case that is this consistent. There were 8 witnesses. The modus operandi was consistent. He acknowledged he had done these same acts. They found the knife. He although he disputed that that was the particular knife because he said, no, that knife I threw away. That he went to the crime scene, did a walkthrough video. He was arrested coming out of the crime scene with another prostitute. It was all there. The state's case was absolutely solid. They got rid of all the charges that they did not have witnesses that they could produce, but they did produce 8 witnesses. They had DNA tying him to 2 of them. When asked about that, when he said, I did all those things, but not to these women, and was asked, well, what about this DNA match? And he said, I never seen them before. So this was not a close case. This was not something that pretty much regardless of what defense counsel said, once this evidence was seen, unfortunately for Mr. Sahin, he was going to be found guilty. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure that everybody in this room knows that in Cook versus State, the state had a very strong case, yet this court reversed there because the adversarial process had been destroyed. And it did not matter what the intent of the defense counsel was, so we do not need to address that. In that case, we had defense counsel whose intent, their sole intent, was to save their client's life. Here, we can speculate, but we don't need to speculate as to why counsel made the comments that he did make. The state says that this is not ripe because we don't know why, and that indicates why this is ripe. To talk about the inference that, well, he might be innocent since he's wanting to go forward without the plea, I would state that would be a fair situation if our counsel had not opined. It's many times there are these plea discussions, and many times defense counsel, we wouldn't refer to them as the idiot clients, but that insist on going to trial despite the state's evidence. But what counsel's responsibility is to go before the judge and say, my client has chosen not to take the plea offer. He doesn't have to explain why. It's his client's choice, and it's his job, it's his duty under the American Bar Association guidelines to advocate with courage and diligence on behalf of his client, and that did not happen here.
Well, I know you'd prefer to have this decided under chronic in this direct appeal.
Yes.
But let's assume, hypothetically, our court decided there was not a complete breakdown in the adversarial system, and then your recourse would be under Strickland. Why wouldn't a Strickland hearing proceeding give you an opportunity for a complete remedy where the entire focus is on the effective assistance of counsel?
There is nothing more that could be developed in a Rule 61 evidentiary hearing? There's nothing more that could be developed that would be relevant to this. The only thing that could be developed is what the state wants, which is the intent of the attorney.
Your view is you would prevail in a Rule 61 hearing?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and adjourn.